Father in heaven, we thank you for the sacred hours of the Sabbath which have already fallen upon us. And so we pray tonight for a double blessing, Lord, a special Sabbath blessing and a blessing upon the presentation of this material tonight. We invite the Holy Spirit to come and be the master teacher of our class and help us to understand all that we're capable of comprehension at our present state of spiritual and intellectual development. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. The title that I chose for this presentation tonight may leave you shaking your head. It's probably the longest title I've ever put on anything, and then we put a subtitle on it too. I called it The Last War, The Last Battle, The Last Enemy, and The Last Trump. And the subtitle, What Can an Intelligent Person Accept About Ellen White and the 21st Century? You may remember that we started last Sabbath afternoon with a statement from Selected Messages, Book 1, page 48, written in 1890. And we mentioned it again last evening that the very last deception of Satan in the church would be to attempt to do two things. One, to destroy Ellen White's credibility as an authentic, legitimate prophet of the Lord. And the second would be to create a satanic hatred against those writings, satanic in its origin, satanic in its intensity. And I mentioned that I thought that the at least three dozen anti-Ellen White websites on the internet were certainly a partial fulfillment of that particular prediction. I don't know how long I had been working at the White Estate. I joined them in 1981 and I retired in 1993, 12 years and 3 months later. I think it probably was around 1984 or 85. My secretary came into my office and she brought the mail that had come for the day. And she also brought a return receipt requested postcard, because in the mail was a registered letter from Australia, and the person who sent it wanted to know for sure that the person who was addressed got it, and so I had to sign my signature on the card, which was then sent back airmail to Australia to prove that I had really gotten this envelope. In the 12 years and 3 months that I worked in that office, it was the only registered letter that I ever got, so you can imagine that I still remember it rather vividly. Inside, one of our church members in Australia had a couple of pages which purported to be statements by Ellen White, and as soon as I looked at them, I recognized the kind of material with which I was going to have to deal with this man. And he said, Brother Kuhn, would you tell me, number one, did Ellen White make these statements? And number two, if she did, would you be sure that we have a correct verbatim transcript of these statements? If it's not correct, I want you to edit it so that it is correct. And then let me know. Reply. I looked at the statements. Most of them were fairly accurate, verbatim. I had to do a little editing, minor editing on several of the statements. In his letter, he didn't ask me why Mrs. White wrote these particular statements. They were in the area of the scientific, statements on science. When you looked at them, they looked totally off the wall. In fact, in my seminary class at Andrews, we spent a class period dealing with some of them. And when I read to the seminary students some of these statements, they put their hand up to their mouth to keep themselves from laughing out loud because they just sounded so outlandish, so off the wall. Well, he didn't ask me how I could explain or could I explain. He just simply said, I want to know, did she say it or didn't she? And I clearly intuited that if I wrote back and said, yeah, these are Ellen White's statements, that he would then say to himself, well, that settles the Ellen White thing for me. A prophet could never make such outlandish, such outrageous statements as these. And in this category, I have found 15, 16, maybe 18 different statements in the area of the scientific, in which at first blush, they just, you say, you know, how could a prophet write something like that? And there are two subjects. There are two subjects upon which more people who lose confidence in Ellen White do it over these two subjects than almost anything else from my experience. This is one of the two, and the other is the so-called plagiarism issue, in which some people get totally turned off because they discover that Ellen White used some of the literary materials of other uninspired writers in her inspired writings. And that is a subject, when this first arose in the early 1980s, I spent two whole class periods at the seminary dealing with the plagiarism issue. As the thing kind of receded, we finally came to just dealing with it with one, but the outline, the printed outline in the seminary, I always hand my students a printed outline, and the printed outline for the lecture on the plagiarism issue is 39 pages in length. We just quickly hit the high points of it in the 50 minutes that we have together in the class. But tonight we're going to talk about the category of the scientific, and we may be able to cover four, possibly even five, of these 16, 17, 18 statements, and we'll see what conclusions we can come to. The first one has to do with what you and I today would probably call wigs, artificial hair, and artificial hair pads. Writing in the Health Reformer, which was this church's first health magazine, in the October 1871 edition on page 121, Ellen White spoke about artificial hair and pads or wigs, which covered the base of the brain. The heat they produced great heat. They excited the spinal nerves. Blood rushes to the brain, causes unnatural activity, tends to recklessness in morals of heart and mind, being in danger of being corrupted. The moral intellectual powers become servants of the animal nature, almost impossible to arouse the moral sensibility. The victim loses the power to discern sacred things. This congestion causes natural hair to fall out. It produces baldness. Many have lost their reason, become hopelessly insane by following this deforming fashion. They suffer horrible disease, premature death, because of their desire to be in the fashion of the day. And you are smiling and might even be laughing behind your hand. Well, don't feel embarrassed, because my seminary students did exactly the same thing. I want you to think for a moment why you find this amusing, why you find it funny. My seminary students found it amusing and hilarious because of a basic assumption that wigs today and wigs back in her day were one and the same thing, and they weren't. When you begin, and this evening I'm going to share with you some research that I did because I wanted to get to the bottom of this thing. When you find out what she was talking about, it bore virtually no resemblance to wigs that people wear today in the 21st century. The first thing that came to me as I was doing research was a letter from a former student of mine. He came to PUC, when I was teaching at PUC, as an older student. He was a convert. He was probably 10 years older than the average Pacific Union College student at that time. We became very good friends, and later on he wrote to me, and this is what he said. He said, a few years ago, while pursuing a theatrical interest, while he was still not an Adventist, I read about the history of wig making. Today, wigs are lightweight, with an open weave stretch cap holding them on the head, and they allow the scalp to breathe. But in Ellen White's time, this was not the way that they were made. The hairstyles and construction were heavier. At the base was a tight-fitting, tightly woven cap that did not allow the scalp to breathe. Such wigs could easily have stifled the flow of blood, as well as limited oxygen to the scalp, retaining perspiration so that it could not escape. So what Ellen White was talking about were wigs that are radically different from the kind of wigs with which you and I may be familiar today. Furthermore, in one of those early health reformers in the year 1867, the writer described one of those typical Whigs of that particular day, and he spoke of it as a monstrous bunch of curled hair, cotton, seagrass, wool, Spanish moss, and other multitudinous abominations, and they give to the wearer a very wide awake look. This chignon was not imported, but it had been shorn from the head of a dear friend, but that did not prevent it from generating an unusual degree of heat in the back part of the head and producing a distracting headache as long as it was worn. In 1871, there was another description in the Health Reformer, which quoted a contemporary newspaper, the Marshall, Massachusetts Statesman and Springfield Republican, and it described the physiological peril of wearing something that they called jute switches. This was a kind of wig. These were wigs that were made basically from a dark, fibrous bark of a tree. It seems that these decorations were often infested with jute bugs, small insects, which then would burrow under the scalp of the wearer. And then they described a clinical description of one woman who wore one of these jute switches, and her life was in peril. Her head became raw, and the hair began to fall out. Her entire scalp was perforated with the burrowing parasites who betrayed their residence by little bunches, which, when punctured, would let them forth. It might be possible thus to slaughter them in detail, but for the fact that they breed under the skin and their reproduction goes on almost endlessly. This lady had consulted several physicians, but without help, and had used every application which seemed to promise relief, but entirely in vain. She is represented as nearly crazy from the terrible suffering and pain and from the prospect of the horrible death which physicians do not seem able to avert. Then I came across another article, which I found very interesting, which appeared in a secular magazine in August of 1910. The magazine was entitled The Watchman, but most of the material in this particular article was abstracted from another publication the month before in July of 1910. The magazine was called McClure's. That was a very popular magazine in that time, but is no longer published today. And in the article, well, it's in the section, it's in a department called Home and Health, and the title of the story is The False Hair Industry. And it told about a government investigator who was investigating child labor conditions in New York City, and these children were putting together wigs made from human hair, which came from China. And so the investigator, the agent who was investigating this thing, got into checking it out where this stuff had all come from, and they discovered that the hair, and I'm reading now from this article, the hair which arrives in Hong Kong from the interior of China is supposed to be taken from the heads of dead persons, dead corpses. Much of it retains its roots and seems to have been pulled out, not cut off. Living Chinamen are, of course, particularly adverse to parting with their pigtails. Stories are current of people who have caught leprosy or bad skin disease from these infected switches. In one authenticated case of leprosy in Brooklyn, the doctor asserts that the disease was caught from false hair. Although it is very difficult to disinfect hair adequately, bacteriological experts say that it is unlikely that leprosy is being brought from China in this way, but there is a fair chance, however, that plague germs may be so transmitted, since in China the many bodies of the plague victims of all classes are thrown into the street and they're rifled by the dregs of the population. The boiling and chemical soakings of the Chinese imported hair during the process of transformations should effectually kill all the germs, but on the other hand, dirty and clean hair are thoroughly mixed in the tenement workrooms and passed through the same combs. So this was a very serious problem which the people were facing in those days, who purchased and wore wigs of a different nature than, of course, what we have today. So when you understand what Mrs. White was talking about, and you recognize that your initial assumption that when she's talking about wigs, she's talking about the same thing that you and I think of when we're talking about wigs, you begin to understand that the situation was quite different. In that same health reformer of October 1871, Mrs. White wrote an article which was entitled "The Fatal Effects of Painting," and she was not using hyperbole when she used the word fatal. She was talking about terminal, the fatal effects of painting. And this is just a little quick summary of what was in that article. "The seeds of death and paralysis are hidden in every pot and jar of these supposedly innocent mixtures. Some who have used them experience sudden severe illness. Others go through life permanently disfigured with bad complexion." She's talking about cosmetics in her day. "Others will physically drop suddenly with their features twisted on one side, perhaps deprived of the use of their limbs. Others die outright, no one guessing why. The individual effect on any given person is difficult to determine in advance. One may be killed outright, another paralyzed, and the only safety is have nothing to do with any of these baleful cosmetic preparations." Again, we smile, assuming that cosmetics in her day were the same thing as cosmetics in our day, and this really sounds outlandish, but such is not the case. First of all, in Ellen White's day, there was no Federal Food and Drug Administration to ride herd on the cosmetic industry. And by the way, the last year for which I was able, in limited research, to get figures on that industry, just in the United States in 1988, that's 12 years ago, the cosmetic industry was a $17 billion a year industry. I am sure it is much more by today. Anyway, there was no Federal Food and Drug Administration to ride herd, but in a way, that's almost irrelevant because, as I'm going to demonstrate to you tonight, the FDA almost today almost totally ignores, in their control of food and drug situations, almost totally ignores the cosmetic industry in their oversight and supervision. But Mrs. White said in an article, another article, she gave her own personal testimony. James White, if you've seen pictures of him, is kind of bald. And James White was very sensitive about his baldness, as some bald people are today. And so they had all kinds of nostrums, snake oil kinds of things, that were being sold from the back of wagons back in those days by peddlers who went from town to town in horse-drawn conveyances. And so James White bought something which was called Mrs. A.S. Allen's World Hair Restorative. And then he bought another bottle which was called Hall's Vegetable Silician Hair Restorative. Maybe the fact that it was vegetable attracted him to it, since his wife is now promoting vegetarianism. I don't know. But anyway, this is what Mrs. White herself wrote, because he asked her to apply this to his hair, thinning as it was, on the top of his head. Mrs. White said, "I observed that when using these preparations, James frequently complained of giddiness of the head and weakness and pain in his eyes. In applying these preparations, my eyes, that were naturally strong, grew weak, and on two different occasions they seemed to be greatly inflamed. Eruptions began to appear on my eyelids, and continued to remain there for weeks. I was convinced that I was being poisoned by applying these preparations to the head of my husband. We finally discontinued the use of these altogether, and I then had no more weakness of eyes ever since. My husband has been free from the peculiar sensations experienced while using these preparations, and my experience has been for 20 years that pure, soft water is best for my head and my hair. Well, there have been problems even in modern times. In 1959, the Washington Star, which no longer publishes, I think it was replaced by the Washington Times in Washington, D.C., published a great big story. You can see the size of the story from this copy I have in my hand. And it said 17 of the coal tar dyes used in lipstick have been found to be toxic, that is, poisonous, by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. The toxic dyes range in color from yellow to orange to red. Used singly and in blends, the lipstick shades derived from the taboo colors are infinite. And in this case, the Federal Food and Drug Administration stepped in and made those manufacturers take out those 17 different dyes. While I was doing some research on this subject, there was a story in U.S. News and World Report about lead poisoning and what a problem it was. This is in 1987, 13 years ago. What a problem lead poisoning was here in America. Particularly, they were concerned about dinnerware, which was being imported from outside the United States, which had lead in it, and these were creating problems, especially for children. And in the article, it said lead, unlike such metals as copper and zinc, is nutritionally useless. It is solely a poison, especially for children who absorb the element more efficiently than do adults. And then it said the early symptoms of lead poisoning, and then it identified a few of them, irritability, headache, and nausea, can be subtle, according to Dr. Julian Chisholm, who directs the Lead Poisoning Center at Francis Scott Key Medical Center in Baltimore. And I read that, and something rang a bell in my head. And I said, I wonder what Dr. Chisholm would say if I read him the thing that I just read to you a couple of moments ago, if I read that to him in connection with a little interview asking him what he thought of the symptoms described by Mrs. White. It took me 7 months to get an appointment with Dr. Chisholm at Johns Hopkins University. This is one of the fringe benefits of being famous. His name appears in a national news magazine and everybody beats a path to his door. It took me 7 months to get an appointment. I finally got one. I went over to his office Lead Poisoning Center at Francis Scott Key Medical Center, Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. I went in and I told him that I had read about his report in U.S. News and World Report, and I said I wanted to read to him a description from the 19th century about people who were experiencing a problem, ostensibly from cosmetics, and I wanted to get his input on it. And so I read him what I just read you a moment ago. He didn't smile. He said, you have just described to me the classic symptoms of lead poisoning. And then he said, you go down to the Library of Congress. And he gave me a little bibliography of books going all the way back to the times of Egypt where they used lead and antimony and mercury in cosmetics, very deadly poisons. And he said, you can go down and you can read up on this. He said, I don't find this amusing at all. I told him that my students at the seminary found it rather amusing. He said, I don't find it amusing at all. He said, those are the classic symptoms of lead poisoning. And he said, you will discover, as you research this out at the Library of Congress, you will discover that in the middle of the 19th century, these poisons were active ingredients in many of the cosmetic preparations that were being sold. And people were literally going crazy. They were dying. This business of suddenly twisting and all that, he said, classic symptoms of lead poisoning. Well, I discovered that it was a problem right there in Maryland at the time. The health department in Montgomery County, this was a newspaper clipping in a little local tri-county free press, Burtonsville, Maryland. The health department cautions against lead poisoning dangers, and it was a very contemporary problem at the time. And then, in September of 1988, I had my first invitation to go to Newfoundland, that delightful island, which is just off the coast of Nova Scotia. There are 98 or 99 miles of water. Normally it takes 4 hours to make the transit on a ferry in your car. The day we went, it took 6 hours because there was a bad storm, and my wife is particularly susceptible to motion sickness. Coming back, we had a delightful, uneventful trip, but going up was quite a problem. The first day, leaving Washington, D.C. early in the morning, I got as far as, I think it was Bangor in the state of Maine, before I had to stop for the night at a motel. This was on a Sunday. As I went into the motel room, I flipped the TV on to CNN headline news to catch up on what had been going on during the day while I was traveling. And I tapped into a little segment. In fact, it lasted 1 minute and 41 seconds. I later timed it. A little segment in which there was a report on a congressional hearing that was going on exactly at that time in Washington, D.C., by a congressman from the state of Oregon whose name was Ron Wyden. Today, Mr. Wyden is a senator, U.S. senator from the state of Oregon. But back in 88, he was a member of the House of Representatives, and he was the chairman of a subcommittee in the Commerce Department, which investigated problems related to the Food and Drug Administration and these kinds of things. And I listened in wide-eyed surprise to that 1 minute and 41 second presentation. And the next morning, before I left the motel, I phoned my secretary back at the General Conference. I told her what I had heard. I told her what time it came on, CNN Eastern Time. And I said to her, I said, I want you first of all to contact CNN in Atlanta, which is their headquarters, and I want you to get me, if you can, a verbatim transcript of what that 1 minute and 41 seconds bit was all about. Then I want you to contact the office of Congressman Ron Wyden, because he will certainly have a press release out reporting on his investigation for the newspaper, for the media. And I said, I want you to get both of those right away so that when I get back from Newfoundland, I can check this thing out, because I said, this is dynamite. And when I got back from my week in Newfoundland, I had this transcript from CNN, and I had this press release, which is entitled News from Congressman Ron Wyden. And this is what it was all about. A review of the 3,000 most commonly used chemicals in the cosmetics business indicates that more than one-third of them are toxic, poisonous. Many of those chemicals, like benzene, mercury, and ammonia, produce or are suspected of producing harmful side effects. Then Ron Wyden appeared on camera and made this statement. 314 of these chemicals are reported to cause biological mutation. This is 1988. These are chemicals in cosmetics in North America, over-the-counter things that you buy at the drugstore in 1988. This is not Ellen White's 19th century. 314 of these 3,000 most commonly used chemicals cause biological mutation. 218 are reported to cause reproductive complications. 778 are capable of causing acute toxicity. 146 of them are reported to cause tumors. And 376 ingredients are reported to cause skin and eye irritations. Then the CNN reporter came back on and said, although a 1975 law, 13 years earlier, makes manufacturers responsible to substantiate the safety of their product before putting it on the market, the FDA requires no safety tests. The FDA generally relies on consumer complaints, which are voluntarily passed along from the industry before launching an investigation, and the agency has no data on the long-term effects of cosmetics on consumers, producers, or handlers of the product. And then they produced on camera the FDA commissioner himself, and this is what he said. There are some products where we might have concern, but on balance, we're less concerned with cosmetics than any of the other things that we regulate. Then the reporter said, Wyden estimates that there were 47,000 cosmetic-induced incidents just in last year, which would have been 1987, a figure that the industry disputes. And so then I went to see Congressman Wyden's news release, and this is what it said on September 15, 1988. Today, the subcommittee continues its examination of the health and safety issues that are increasingly at stake in the $17 billion U.S. cosmetic industry. And before he gets on to the current, he refers back to an earlier hearing that was held in Congress on July 14 of that year, 1988, where witnesses told, under oath, witnesses told the subcommittee of Congress how dangerous these products can be. The subcommittee heard how one consumer's hair caught on fire, leaving her permanently disfigured and in constant pain. Cosmetologists, these beauty operators, explained how they had suffered irreparable nervous system damage. Sounds like Mrs. White with that hair restorative, doesn't it? How cosmetologists, beauty shop operators, had suffered irreparable nervous system damages, memory loss, and severe respiratory problems. The evidence showed that consumers cannot be sure that the thousands of cosmetics presently on the market are safe. The Food and Drug Administration, the agency responsible for overseeing the safety and efficiency of products, does not have the same broad-reaching authority to regulate cosmetics that it has for food and drugs. And it went on to two pages. That was in 1988. In 1991, 3 years later, Consumer Reports, which is a citizen watchdog organization, and Consumer Reports does not take advertising so that they could never be swayed to give a positive report on some company when they might deserve a negative report. And so they take no advertising whatever, Consumer Reports. And they had a very substantial story in Consumer Reports, February of 1991. 3 years after Wyden's investigation, the headline reads, "The law provides little protection." And it goes on and pretty much replicates what Congressman Wyden had reported. 1994, this is only 6 years ago, Dan Rather's CBS Evening News on television had an item, and I was able to get an exact verbatim transcript. It runs to two pages on an item, and it was reported on one of the newest popular cosmetics is a skin treatment called alpha hydroxy acid. It can be very effective, but as the correspondent Deborah Norville reported, it can also be very dangerous. And it talked about how people suffered second degree burns on their face, on their eyelids, using this alpha hydroxy. So, and that was 1994, only 6 years ago. Well, the thing that Ellen White described doesn't sound so far-fetched when you realize first what was being sold back there. And as this scientist at Johns Hopkins University told me lead, mercury, antimony, and many of these other heavy metals, poisonous metals, were involved as ingredients in many of these things. And then when you hear what is currently going on in the cosmetics industry, her statement doesn't sound so off the wall as it may initially have sounded. Well, let's come to another thing. In one of her earliest writings on health in Spiritual Gifts Book 4, which came out in the 1870s, I think, or 1860s, Mrs. White talked about pork. And one of the things she said was that one of the reasons that God forbade it was because you could contract leprosy from the eating of pork. This briefly is a summary of it. What she said, pork was forbidden to the Israelites by God because it caused scrofula. Now, you probably don't recognize that term. I had to look it up in the dictionary. Scrofula is tuberculosis of the lymph glands, especially in the neck. So pork caused scrofula. It caused leprosy and cancerous humors. Leprosy was a potential hazard, especially in that warm climate of the Sinai Desert. Also, swine's flesh, above all other flesh meats, produced a bad state of the blood. It affected the mind, and the finer sensibilities are blunted by its use. So I started to investigate that one, because, of course, today there is no direct scientific evidence to support that statement. And there are a lot of people who read it and laugh and say that's just the imagination of some woman living back in the 19th century. I got in touch with Dr. Ray Foster, who only recently retired at Loma Linda. He was the head of a leprosy study unit at Loma Linda University Medical School. And Dr. Foster has done a great deal of research in the area of medicine with regard to leprosy. I even called him on the telephone and talked with him long distance. And I said, Dr. Foster, do we have any scientific evidence that would tend to support Mrs. White's statement that the eating of pork could cause, doesn't always have to cause, but could cause, even cause leprosy? He said, there is no direct evidence yet. But in our experiments in Loma Linda, which have been published in scientific journals, we have discovered with two groups of mice, a control group and the experimental group, we have discovered that mice, rodents, which were given a pork diet, showed a significantly greater predisposition to leprosy than the rodents that were on a non-pork diet. And later on, they tried swabbing the skin with a solution made up of pork, and they found that the rodents that had this put topically on their skin were more predisposed to contracting leprosy than were the control group. Well, in 1983 in the United States, there was a very interesting article, a two-page article, which appeared in the January 30, 1983 issue. These are copies of the clipping. Appeared in a San Antonio daily newspaper called the San Antonio Light. And it said that in 1983, there were people getting leprosy, Hansen's disease is what it's called today, from eating armadillo meat. Now, I don't know what connection there may be physiologically between an armadillo and a pig. They both have a superficial physical resemblance. You know, the armadillo looks like some prehistoric animal with armor plate all over its body. I'll never forget the first time I saw one loose. I was at the Texas camp meeting, and I got up early. I try to get exercise every day, usually walking at least for an hour. And I was walking down a road. The sun was just beginning to come up. It was still just a little bit dark. And I noticed there was a shadow moving over on the other side of the road. And I drew up closer to it, and it was an armadillo that was out foraging for food. And when he saw me, he scooted across the field to get away from me. the eating of armadillo meat will cause leprosy, or as it is called today in scientific circles, Hansen's disease. And in 1983, according to the San Antonio newspaper article, there were 1,000 cases of leprosy, Hansen's disease, being treated in California, another 500 cases of leprosy being treated in Hawaii, 430 in Texas, 106 in Florida, and 88 in Louisiana. Worldwide, in that year, there were an estimated 15 million cases, new cases, of Hansen's disease or leprosy. The research shows that the armadillo is 20 times more susceptible to Hansen's disease than are humans, and the eating of an infected armadillo is known to be one of the established causes of Hansen's disease. The number of cases of the disease in the United States, the newspaper went on to report, continues to rise annually. And when I went down to South America for the first time, which I think was 1985, I've been down there two or three times during the course of my work in the White Estate to lecture in all three of our universities. We have a university near Lima, Peru. We have another in Brazil, and then another in Argentina. And when I got to Argentina, I went into a little tourist trinket store, souvenir store, and I was interested to see that they had little miniature armadillos. And I asked the lady at the counter, who spoke English, fortunately, because my Spanish is very limited. I said to her, I haven't seen these armadillos in other countries in South America. No, she said, they're almost exclusively to be found in Argentina. I said, that's interesting. I was thinking about leprosy in connection with the armadillo. She went on to volunteer the information that the armadillo was the unofficial mascot of the country of Argentina. And then I did a little inquiring, and I discovered that Argentina also is the only country in South America that has a leprosarium. Very definitely a link between eating armadillo and contracting Hansen's disease, or leprosy as it is sometimes called. There's still no connection, direct scientific connection, between the eating of pork and the acquiring of leprosy. But if you can get it from eating those fat armadillos, it may not take too much more scientific research to discover that it's possible to get it from the eating of pork, as Mrs. White said. Now, on this one, I hope I don't annoy anybody. I'm going to talk about cheese. And sometimes people become very annoyed at me because I talk about cheese and what Ellen White had to say. Well, incidentally, I am indebted to a member of this church for some information that I got just a couple of days ago right here in Davenport, an update on something that is very significant in this whole discussion. I got interested in cheese because some people were making a big thing out of it in the church and saying that, you know, it's almost a test of fellowship. If you eat cheese, you can't be an Adventist. Well, that's not so. But Ellen White did talk about cheese, and I finally decided I'm going to research this thing out and find out what it's all about. And so I collected every statement that Mrs. White ever made on the subject of cheese. I put them in chronological, historical order. And then I started studying to see what she wrote. The earliest statement I could find was in Volume 2 of the Testimonies, which was written in 1868. And remember, that was only 5 years after her first major health reform vision. She had two visions dealing with health reform before June 6, 1863. But 1863 was her first major one, in which there were 10 different emphases in this kind of omnibus vision that was given to her. So this was only 5 years after that. And in 1868, she wrote, "Cheese should never be introduced into the human stomach." In 1905, in Ministry of Healing, which was published that year, Mrs. White said cheese is wholly unfit for food. Now, I was interested in that because I had heard somewhere that when Ministry of Healing in 1906, the very next year, was translated into the German language, that there was negotiation between the translators in Germany and Mrs. White directly about this statement that cheese is wholly unfit for food. And the statement was modified in the German language with Ellen White's approval to read, "strong, sharp cheese should not be eaten." That was the way it translated back into English from the German. That was her authorized statement in the German language. And so I got interested in this thing and I started doing some research. And I found out that there were at least five or six conditions in her day which certainly would have prompted a statement such as that. For example, in her day, pasteurization was not widely practiced in the dairy industry, and bacteria, therefore, multiplied very quickly. Secondly, it was quite customary in the dairies of the United States in 1900 and about that time, the 1890s and 1900, they often watered milk down, added water to milk in order to stretch it, make it go farther, get more money, you see. And so sometimes milk might be a third water when you bought it at the store. Milk was watered down. Often the water itself was polluted, which therefore would, of course, pollute the milk. And the milk sometimes was contaminated by additives to try to turn it back white. You know, sometimes the milk was yellow in color. Nobody's going to buy yellow milk. And so to keep from having to throw out the yellow milk, which came from sick cows, they would put additives in it to try to turn the color back to white. And they would add such things as molasses, chalk, and plaster of Paris to hide the color change. So when you bought milk, that was what you might be getting. Third, the dairies in those days were not inspected by public health department officials, and the dairies were notorious for their filthy conditions. Fourth, there was almost a universal lack of refrigeration, which created serious problems all of its own. And fifth, disease among cows was rampant and was transmitted to the milk and to the cheese. And if you're interested in doing a little exploration about what the conditions were like, I recommend to you a very delightful and somewhat humorous little paperback. It was written by Otto Bettmann, B-E-T-T-M-A-N-N. Dr. Bettmann was the founder of a very famous archives. I think their headquarters is in New York City. All of the news magazines, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News, and World Report, use pictures from the Bettmann archives when they are dealing with historical situations. And Bettmann wrote this book entitled, "The Good Old Days, They Were Terrible." So if you're interested in researching this thing, their chapter on food, their chapter on health, and their chapter on clothing is very revealing and fascinating reading. Well, okay, so someone says, those conditions don't apply today, so therefore it's okay to eat cheese today. And my answer is, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't, because today there are at least six potential problems for people with eating cheese. And let me share those with you. And since this is the age when nobody wants to be accused of plagiarism, let me share with you the source of my research. Dr. Milton Crane, for many years, was research professor of medicine at Loma Linda University, taught in the medical school. He is now, at least the last I had contact with him, which was a couple of years ago, was connected as a volunteer with the Weimar Institute in just out of Sacramento in Northern California. And also Dr. Sang Lee, a Korean physician, who has done a great deal of research on this. And his findings have been so significant that the Korean government sent a television crew, recording crew, over to Weimar. They spent several weeks there, And they recorded 20 or 30 half-hour programs, I understand, with Dr. Sang Lee telling of his findings in this and that and the other thing. He is perhaps better recognized in his own country than he is in the United States, but he is very much involved in the research of this sort of thing. And this is what Dr. Crane, he mentioned four things, and then since I got this information from Dr. Crane, I have discovered two more things that might give one pause about using cheese today. But first of all, Dr. Crane's four points. First of all, he said, today there is a high incidence of leukemia, and I understand that's another word for blood cancer, that there is a high incidence of leukemia among cows in dairy herds in different locations and localities around the United States. Second, cheese contains a high saturated fat content, which is a problem if you are trying to control your cholesterol. And many people are trying to control their cholesterol. Third, cheese often contains a high concentration of sodium salts, which can be a problem for a person in trying to control hypertension or high blood pressure. So if you have a problem with high blood pressure, you may want to be very careful about using cheese and other dairy products. And lastly, many patients who have allergy problems, some of them very acute, often find relief when cheese is discontinued from their diet. And this is where Dr. Sang Lee, he has had what almost seemed to be miraculous cures. People who were suffering, really suffering from allergies, he took them off dairy products, and almost like turning on a light, the problem seemed to evaporate. And after getting Dr. Crane's monograph on dairy products, very shortly after that, I was interested that two of the three major news magazines in the United States, Time Magazine and U.S. News and World Report, both of them, within the space of a few months of each other, ran cover stories dealing with the subject of allergies. The one in U.S. News and World Report, February 20 of 1989, was entitled Allergy Warfare. And then Time Magazine, well, I said within a few months of each other, Time Magazine came out in 1992, the June 22 issue, and this was an interesting story, Allergies, How You Get Them and How You Get Rid of Them. And both of these cover stories in two of the three major U.S. news magazines focused particularly on eggs and dairy products as the source of many allergies unknown to the victim. But when they were removed from the diet, there was almost an immediate and almost a miraculous cure. Now, a few years ago, two or three years ago, we were startled by hearing about something called mad cow disease in England. And the British had a very difficult time, in fact, almost an impossible time, selling their beef to the continent of Europe. After this story came out about mad cow disease, there was concern about mad cow disease in the United States. ABC News, or was it NBC News, did a special feature on mad cow disease. I was able to get the videotape of that particular program. Very fascinating, and the effects of mad cow disease are absolutely disastrous. And if a cow has mad cow disease, you wouldn't want anything to do with the milk that came from that cow. And then, number six, the last one of the reasons why you might want to have a caution about the using of cheese today was something that I got just 2 days ago while I was here. It was a report from a gentleman whose name is Robert Cohen. His title is Executive Director of the Dairy Education Board, which goes by the initials DEB. And in this, he says that in 1994, the Food and Drug Administration approved of the genetically engineered bovine breed cow, growth hormone, small RB, capital GH. Before 1995, lymphatic cancers were comparatively rare in the United States. And then he shows how lymphatic cancers have grown exponentially just in the last 5 years. What this growth hormone in cows does to the people who eat dairy products is to, and also who eat the flesh, is to enlarge the spleen, sometimes half again as large as it was before. And this, the spleen, is the first line of defense for the lymphatic system. And if the spleen goes, the lymphatic system goes. And if that goes, you may come down with lymphatic cancer. Practically unknown before 1994. Then it was approved by the FDA to give to cows as a growth hormone to get them ready for market quicker. And so I have this two-page statement that was shared with me by Jay just this week. Mrs. White, in urging health reform among Adventists, first of all, in 1863, she urged vegetarianism for three categories of reasons: because of mental reasons, because of physical reasons, and because of spiritual reasons. And then she dropped the other shoe about 40 years later, and she said that greater reforms beyond vegetarianism. Now, there's some in our church who haven't even gotten up to vegetarianism yet, but she's going beyond vegetarianism. She says, greater reforms should be seen among the people who claim to be looking for the soon coming of Christ. Health reform, and this was stated in 1902, 98 years ago, health reform is to do among our people a work which it has not yet done. Then, 3 years later, Ministry of Healing, she made this statement. The diet reform, another term for health reform, should be progressive. As disease in animals increases, the use of animal products, and she's here referring specifically to milk and eggs, will become more and more unsafe. In 1901, she had been raising this question of a soon coming need to dispense with the use of animal products as well as the eating of flesh foods. And she said, soon butter will never be recommended, and after a time, milk will be entirely discarded. And then she tells why. For disease in animals is increasing in proportion to the increase of wickedness among men. And then this profound statement. The time will come, future tense, this was back in 1901, the time will come when there will be no safety in using eggs, milk, cream, or butter, referring to these animal products. And then four paragraphs later in that same letter, which was written to, I think, one of our physicians, our people should now experiment on how to prepare food without the use of milk or butter. The time is near. Four paragraphs above, she said, the time will soon come. Now the time is near when the whole animal creation will groan under the disease which curses our earth because of the iniquity of the fallen race. So here were counsels almost a century ago that not only should we abandon the use of flesh foods, but also, before the end, we would need to take an advanced position in health reform by discarding the use of animal products. And the reason is not far to seek, because Mrs. White indicated that there was coming, as the Bible writers had predicted years before, centuries before, that there would be coming a time of trouble such as never was. The seven last plagues will be certainly a time of unmitigated disaster for the world. And those of us who are seeking translation will have to go through that very great time of trouble. And the idea was, as I read her writings, that we need to start building up our body, sort of spring training for the time of trouble, that we need to start building up our bodies so that we will be physiologically able to go through relatively unscathed when that particular time comes. Well, there are about 16 or 18. We've only covered, about four or five of them, these categories in the area of science, in which Mrs. White sounded so off the wall in her day. But it doesn't sound so off the wall when you get a little historical background and also an awareness of the contemporary situation today. As we noted when we began this seminar last Sabbath afternoon, God does not propose to remove all opportunity for doubt. And incidentally, on some of these 16 or 18 statements in science, I have not been able to come up with anything at all that would tend to corroborate scientifically the veracity of her statement. On some things, we may yet get some information. On some things, we may not. God does not propose to remove all opportunity for doubt, because as we mentioned last Sabbath afternoon, if God removed all opportunity for doubt, he simultaneously would remove all opportunity for exercising faith. Those who look for hooks upon which to hang their doubts will find them. Those who refuse to believe until every possible obstacle is removed will, in the end, never come to the faith. To turn from the preponderant weight of evidence will leave one in the cold, chilling atmosphere of unbelief and questioning doubt, and ultimately cause that person to make shipwreck of faith. We also notice that Paul wrote some things that Peter mentions in one of his epistles. Our brother Paul wrote some things that are hard to be understood. But Peter didn't throw Paul's writings out and dismiss them out of hand because he couldn't understand them. And by the way, as we mentioned the other day, Peter, as Paul, had the two highest gifts of the Holy Spirit that there were. Apostleship is gift number one. Prophecy is gift number two. Both of them had the two highest gifts. But dear Peter, Peter probably never even finished synagogue school up there in Capernaum when his daddy took him into the fishing business on Galilee. Whereas Paul was trained in the seminary of Gamaliel in Jerusalem, which was one of the finest educational institutions of the day. So it's understandable that Peter would find some things in Paul that were hard to understand, but he didn't throw Paul's writings out because there were a few things that he couldn't understand. And no wise person will throw the writings of Ellen White out simply because there may be a few things there that we do not understand. God has given us abundant evidence upon which we may base our faith, and the repeated testimony of Ellen White with regard to her own writings, judge from the preponderant weight of the evidence. And so far, having done so, I have discovered in my own research that the preponderant weight of the evidence falls very heavily on the side of Ellen White. Will you bow your heads with me for a closing prayer? Father in heaven, tonight we have looked only at just a few of these statements which sometimes cause mirth, sometimes cause disbelief, sometimes cause at least perplexity in the minds of those who want to believe that your special servant was indeed what this church has always claimed her to be, a divinely inspired prophet of the Lord. Thank you for the evidence that we have been able to share this evening. We recognize, Lord, that there may be some things that we will not really be nailed down 100% before Jesus comes. But if we judge on the basis of the weight of the evidence, then, Lord, we have a basis for faith. Thank you for this gift. Thank you for sharing it with your people to help us in these end times to be ready to meet Jesus in peace. May we be blessed because we are guided by them and guarded by them. May we be saved at last because we heeded the testimony of Jesus. We ask it in his name. Amen.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.